Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, instead of a guest, we're going to have three different topics that take us deeper into some important issues that rarely get an open, honest, and objective conversation going. And you'll have an opportunity throughout the program to call in and share your points of view. We're going to begin by taking a look at why does Google want your DNA? I'm sure you've all seen those ads on television about how with the Ancestry.com, you'll be able to find out about who your ancestors were. And that's a good thing. But what are you not being told? What did you not realize when you signed the contract? What can they do with that information? What can they do with your DNA? You'll find out. The picture gets very dark and dangerous when it is fully revealed. This is never discussed in the mainstream media. In fact, right now, I believe that we are at a tipping point. Not as far as the environment goes. We've already tipped on over half the major tipping points, and they cannot be reversed. It's just a matter of at what point in the near future, in the next 10 years, we start to see multiple cataclysmic events. Well, if you live on the Big Island of Hawaii, you're seeing it right now. If you live in Iran, you had one of the hottest days on record in Iran. In Pakistan, it was 123 degrees, and that's just ambient air. So they are having cataclysmic events. We had the worst fires in California, the most rain and damage from rain in Texas, Category 4 hurricane in Florida, all of Florida, and also in Louisiana, Mississippi, fires that were the worst in the state's history in Oregon, Washington State, and Montana. That's all just in the last 8 months. And that's just a tiny speck of what's going on. That's tipped, gone. There's nothing anyone's going to do at this moment that's going to keep those from tipping. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing things, but it means that the major tipping points have tipped. And when the Arctic goes ice-free this August or September, then you'll start seeing what Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson said would be the beginning of major change, because the heat that is absorbed into the Arctic is going to release methane gas. That in turn is going to cause more global warming. That's going to cause the temperature to change several degrees. When that happens, you won't be able to grow the same quality or quantity of food in Montana, in North Dakota, South Dakota, even in Kansas. Plus, we have massive drought. The city of Cape Town, South Africa, right now, is out of water. In fact, it's not the only major city out of water. There are over 21 major cities that are facing severe water crisis. The trouble is not a single city did anything about it until the crisis happened. But then again, since when did human nature learn to be proactive and do something intelligent? We generally don't. We wait till the disaster, plead our case as being victims of the disaster, and then want everyone to bail us out instead of doing something that we should have known was the right thing to do. So on the environment, scratch that. Okay, we should still continue to be very conscious, but consciousness is not the same as action. At the end of the day, it is not what you think that matters in this world on any level. It's what you do. Everybody thinks they love children, but what about all the children dying in Yemen from cholera, malnutrition, and conflicts? And that's also true of children all over the world. So do we really care about all children or just our children? We say that we care about seniors, and historically that was true. Not today. I can show you millions upon millions of seniors who are alone, lonely, and can't make ends meet. They have no advocates. They're invisible. The poor, over 240 million Americans, invisible. Except when they show themselves, and that is when we don't want to see them. And so we put now bolts that come up through park benches. You put a quarter in and it comes up. So a poor person can't sit on a bench. And we're doing this everywhere, criminalizing being poor. So on the one hand, what we say we are as a society, we want peace. Why do we have 800 military bases around the world? We want peace in the Middle East. Then why did we do nothing to prevent or criticize or investigate the crimes against humanity that are occurring right now in Gaza? where more than 10,000 people living in Gaza have been injured and over 100 killed. Let's just reverse it for a moment, because this audience can handle this. Mainstream media, you'll never see this discussed. Let's just say that starting tomorrow, 10,000 people from any country, it doesn't matter, were coming up to our border. They weren't on the border yet. They weren't at the fence. But the President of the United States gave the authorization to shoot across the Rio Grande River and shoot the people coming, trying to get into the United States. And we injured 10,000 and killed 100. And no one in Congress complained. The media was fully supportive. And corporate America yawned. How do you think that would go down if we killed 100 and injured 10,000, many of those will die, and we did it with malice aforethought, and yet one of those people stepped foot in the United States soil? So when we try to use a little common sense and a lot more brain power than we normally would, we start to see the picture differently. But as long as it's in the Middle East, and as long as we've already demonized Hamas, and I don't support Hamas, I think Hamas's actions are stupid and have always been stupid. But that's separate. But if you believe that everyone who's a Palestinian trusts and believes and supports Hamas, you'd be deadly wrong. But do we want a group of people, over 2 million, living in such squalor without basic services, as if they're in the largest outdoor prison? No, we don't. When was the last time anyone complained about it? The only person today to complain in Congress was Bernie Sanders. The only person. That means 99 other senators said nothing, and no one in the House said anything either. So we have a complicit and compliant, completely obedient media, with the exception of some alternative media, and members of the executive and judicial branches of government, legislative branches, the House, the Senate, and corporate America. As long as it's not affecting profits, nobody cares. So we don't care about obesity and diabetes in children in the United States. We don't care about children being born today that will not outlive their parents because they're so sick. We do not care about environmental toxins and how many different chemicals get into your body. We don't care about genetic engineering, and glyphosate is in virtually everyone's body and everyone's food. And it's a carcinogen. We don't care about a body politic completely purchased by corporate interest and super PACs. We don't care that we don't have one vote per person because those votes are immaterial. We buy elections. You're selected, then you're elected. No one is selected if they don't play by the rules. No one seemed to think that it was odd that every single major corporation, all the media, and all of the pundits were supporting Hillary Clinton. If she's that loved and respected by so many corrupt industries, then you should have questioned that. What is she doing in return? What is the quid pro quo? But we didn't go that far. We never touched the third rail of honesty in our society. We're incapable of honesty. We're incapable of ethics. We're incapable of morality. We moralize, but that's different. There's nothing better than a born-again Christian evangelical minister talking about adultery when he's got six affairs going on the side and a gay relationship. And, of course, he is completely against gays. By the way, did anyone ever look into Mike Pence's background? But that's a separate issue. Now what we have is we have hypocrisy that the whole world sees. We want peace, not in Libya. Have we held anyone accountable for the crimes against humanity? No one. Do we ever look at what we should do, like Germany was put through an infinitesimally mawkish trial at Nuremberg, when you consider how many Germans participate in the war and in the ethnic cleansing, and only a couple hundred were ever held accountable? No, we don't even allow one person. Not a single person can you name from the National Security Agency, the FBI, Homeland Security, none of the former presidents, vice presidents, or cabinets, none of these people have been held accountable for anything, no matter how egregious the crimes they committed, nor will they. That's the game we play. So, now take a look at anything that anyone says in the light of staying in completely independent of an emotional reaction. And then you'll see why what you're going to hear now is so important. Because what you don't pay attention to today, you won't have a choice in the future. It'll be mandated, just like vaccines. And by the way, now one of the most popular programs just started this week on Progressive Radio Network is a program on vaccines. Persons who had vaccine injury, wow. I mean, when Jesse told me the numbers of people tuning in, there's over 4 million parents in the United States who've been victims of the big lie. Vaccines don't cause a problem. Yeah, they do. They've never been proven safe or effective, and the people know that, but that's the power of the official lie. Just like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the big lie. No one was held accountable, and the very people, pundits then, are appearing on television now telling us what else is wrong in the world and why we should intervene. No one apologized when Libya was destroyed. No one apologized for Hillary Clinton's coup in Honduras or her and Gloria Nuland's fiasco in supporting fascism in Ukraine. No one said anything about all the creation and funding and training of ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, to go against Libya and Syria. So we say we're against terrorism, but we're the world's largest supporter of terrorism. Does anyone see the intellectual and moral disconnect? So the difference is I'm optimistic only for those people who are wise enough and courageous enough to live an authentic life. The rest of the people, not so much. Now listen in carefully, because this is what Google's really doing when it comes to wanting your DNA. I think you'll find this interesting.
Hey, Internet friends. Within all of us are traces of the past, present, and future. We carry the imprint of our ancestors, which resulted in the sequence of right now. Us in this moment, chock full of quirks our children will inherit, all written into our DNA. The hereditary material found in everyone, but is so specific and unique to an individual that it can reveal how likely we are to have freckles, how we interpret different tastes and smells, if we're carriers for certain diseases, and how our genes indicate our overall well-being. DNA tells a story, acting as a roadmap through our body's deeply intimate data. An individual's DNA is more identifying than a name, a social security number, or even a fingerprint. So why is a multinational tech company with a focus on internet-related services and products so interested in the genetic codes of millions of strangers? Why does a company that data mines from you want to mine DNA from you? And most importantly, why does Google want your DNA? Let me begin by introducing you to the Wojcicki sisters. You probably already know Susan. She served as the CEO of YouTube since 2014. Her sister, Janet, is a professor of pediatrics, with a great deal of her work taking place in Africa. The youngest sister, Anne, is the CEO of 23andMe, a for-profit human genome research company that allows consumers to study their ancestry, genealogy, and inherited traits. Anne was once married to Sergey Brin, Google's co-founder and current president of Google's parent company, Alphabet Inc. The story goes a little something like this. In 1998, Susan rented out a garage to Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Susan was hired as Google's 18th employee, and Sergey married her sister Anne in 2007, 1 year after Anne co-founded 23andMe. If you are wondering about the 23, it represents the number of chromosome pairs in humans. The company began as a mail-order genetics testing firm backed by investors like Anne's husband. The company offers kits that test and produce reports, which reveal anything from your ancestry to whether or not you carry genetic markers that are associated with risk for certain health conditions, to reports on your overall wellness and muscle composition and your likelihood of inheriting certain traits, ranging from hair color to how your body responds to alcohol or caffeine. All you have to do is purchase the kit, register it, spit in a tube, mail your prepaid package back to 23andMe, and then wait several weeks for your results. 23andMe's biobank is the world's largest repository of DNA samples. This biobank contains extensive health information on millions of individuals, and these DNA samples were willingly provided by paying customers. Selling access to this biobank to undisclosed third parties is a major source of profit for 23andMe. They've essentially monetized the human genome, which is all the genetic information on a person, packaged and sold like a commodity. This is probably why Google Ventures, the investment arm of Google, continues to financially back 23andMe, because Google already stores categories of the world's information. Having the world's largest repository of DNA samples certainly gives them an advantage in the multi-billion dollar medical field. Though, to build this biobank and continue to profit, 23andMe is always searching for new ways to get customers to join. That's probably why you recognize the Rainbow Box Kit that has been heavily marketed across television and the internet. Propagated endlessly on Ancestor's Stronghold, YouTube, by some of the same influencers who have interviewed the president at the White House and hosted Bill Gates on their channel. Other video makers create sponsored videos detailing their test results, showcasing special and unique details about themselves to their captive audience. You can see their sponsored referral links in their video descriptions. The packaging of this sponsored content often mirrors the packaging of the 23andMe kit. Adorned with rainbow imagery, framing this whole pay-to-get-your-DNA stored in a biobank as harmless entertainment. But if we traveled somewhere over the rainbow, and we discovered a lab in which we could put 23andMe under a microscope, would we observe only harmless entertainment for the consumer? Would 23andMe's mission statement to help people access, understand, and benefit from the human genome, would this mission statement stand tall amongst other noble pursuits? Or would we see a more complex reality? We've already identified 23andMe's Silicon Valley roots with 23andMe's personal and professional relationship with Google. Google's parent company, Alphabet Inc., resides in Silicon Valley amongst other juggernauts like Apple, Amazon, and even Twitter, companies that sell our data to third parties. And of course, the government can access this data as well. All they usually need is a warrant. We've allowed these companies to have access to our minds, our homes, our fingerprints, and now our DNA, because we believed we were the customer when we were actually the product. Plus, we didn't have time to read over those dozens of pages of terms and conditions. Ain't nobody got time for that.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Now that we've established how the human genome is monetized by companies like 23andMe, let's discuss the privacy concerns, the potential for weaponization, and how the brave new world of the for-profit genome industry affects everyone. Concern over access to an individual's DNA data reignited back in April when California law enforcement announced the arrest of suspect Joseph James DeAngelo, otherwise known as the Golden State Killer, a name given to a serial killer from the 1970s. Recently, investigators reanalyzed the DNA found at one of the crime scenes, ran the results through a DNA base which linked back to one of DeAngelo's relatives. That's how they were able to tie him to the murders. While we can all agree it's great that they might have found a serial killer, how are we to know that this data is secure? Or who has access to it? With DNA being a revealing source of information about an individual, this is where the water begins to get murky. Your DNA sequence isn't yours alone. You share it with your relatives. And even though companies like 23andMe say they remove your information like your name and address when they allow third parties to access your DNA, anonymized DNA will never be truly anonymous because genes serve as identifying information. Studies have revealed that researchers could correctly uncover people's surnames from their genetic data alone with the aid of a DNA database. While the United States government already has most of our DNA on file if you were born in a hospital, joined the military, or were incarcerated in some states, DNA databases make it all the more convenient to nail you to a crime. With this new era of DNA testing, DNA altering services have emerged along with gene editing tools. So criminals could, theoretically, have their DNA permanently altered to avoid a repeat of this Golden State Killer situation. Doesn't gene editing sound like the basis of some weird sci-fi movie? Well, often the truth is stranger than fiction. For example, Google Ventures founder Bill Maris dismissed the fight to protect the privacy of genetic data, stating that if we keep our genetic information a secret, then we're all going to die. Someone needs to break it to old Bill that no one makes it out of life alive. But apparently, he's pretty dedicated to the concept of immortality. Maris is the founder of Calico, who also invests in Ancestry DNA. The goal of Calico is to hack the DNA of life and combat the effects of aging. Back in 2013, when Maris was asked about the research going on at Google Ventures, Maris indicated that the research could extend the human lifespan to 500 years, and he urged folks to embrace the idea of a life everlasting. But here's the thing, members of the upper echelon already use their platform to push the narrative that overpopulation is a problem. And in the future, the Earth's resources will be exhausted without population control. But if an extended lifespan is achieved, wouldn't overpopulation worsen? So how would it be determined who is allowed to live that long? Who can reproduce? Who gets to decide? Have you heard that scientists have linked genes to intelligence? 23andMe said it's not telling people their brain rating out of concern that information would be poorly received. So brain scores from DNA tests are being documented, just not disclosed to the consumer. What standards or incentives are in place for accuracy on reporting these scores amongst for-profit companies, whether it be scores for wellness or intelligence? And if the goal of 23andMe investors like Google Ventures is to extend the lifespan and eventually achieve immortality, will brain scores play a factor in who is approved to live that long? 23andMe already holds a designer baby patent, through which parents could predict certain traits in children. More specifically, what has been patented is the method of predicting, from parents' DNA, the likelihood their baby would have certain traits. The patent itself describes how the system could be utilized in fertility clinics, where the baby's sex, weight, eye color, intelligence, or personality characteristics, and even their risks for certain medical conditions could be decided upon before the baby is even conceived. While 23andMe reported they have no plans to use this designer baby system to the fullest extent, this does sound like a slippery slope to eugenics or the science of improving a human population by controlled breeding to increase the occurrence of desirable heritable characteristics, which, spoiler alert, has already been practiced in the United States and resulted in compulsory sterilization of patients in mental hospitals and the creation of the Negro Project in 1939 by Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger, which yielded in a push for birth control amongst African American communities. Eugenics in the United States is not limited to these examples, but they do serve as a cautionary tale that yes, eugenics happened long ago and these eugenicists are still around today. Which brings us to our next point. Did you know there's such a thing as ethnobombs? Think of a biological weapon like anthrax or even the bubonic plague, but the weapon is tailored to target sequences that belong to specific ethnicities. In 1998, it was reported that Israel was developing a biological weapon targeted at Arab genes, leaving the ethnically Jewish unharmed. The ethnobomb they aimed to create was a genetically modified bacterium or virus. That was 20 years ago. Recently, it was revealed that Google has been providing the US military with their artificial intelligence technology. Is this why Google met with the White House 427 times during President Obama's tenure? How long until 23andMe's biobank is utilized by third parties like the US military to develop genetically targeted biological weapons? Or is that already taking place? While biological warfare has been around for some time, it seems like we have a few more years until designer babies are a reality for the average citizen. Right now, a potential soft eugenics is beginning to form, not at all the sole responsibility of 23andMe. The blame really falls on the behalf of American legislators, who are in the deep pockets of lobbyists. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2008 prohibits some types of genetic discrimination in obtaining health insurance and employment. But there are loopholes. Last year, members of Congress attempted to remove a portion of the genetic privacy protection, allowing employers to demand to see their employees' genetic information. This is worrisome when we factor in the rise of direct-to-consumer DNA testing, the market of which is projected to grow exponentially over the next decade. On the 23andMe website, the fine print reads, if you are asked by an insurance company whether you have learned genetic information about health conditions and you do not disclose them, well, it may be considered fraud on your behalf. So in the future, when the trend continues to show that our legislators favor corporations over citizens, if your aunt or your brother or your grandma take a DNA test and their results reveal they have a propensity towards a difficult to treat condition, will your employer or your insurer drop you after having access to your family's DNA reports? With the average American not being able to cover the costs of out-of-pocket healthcare, will we see a rise in deaths associated with treatable conditions once insurance companies have access to these reports and individuals' genes are used against them? So let's circle back to this question. Why does Google want your DNA? While I realize the possibilities and examples I provided in this video paint a dark picture, it's important you understand that even the smallest act can change the course of the future. The purpose of this video is not to belittle your wants or desires of discovering information about yourself and your family, but my goal here is to illustrate that we've allowed companies to have access to our homes, our minds, and now our DNA. Yes, technology is a double-edged sword. It has the potential to help and to harm. If we look back on our history with these tech companies like Google, we'd see that our privacy was never taken from us. We gave it up willingly. But that doesn't mean we have to keep repeating this pattern. Please take a moment to research the risks associated with any service you use. Whether it's posting a picture of your newborn baby on Facebook or sending a vial of your spit to a DNA testing company. What do you think, internet friends? Have you ever used these DNA testing services?
So there, that's our first story that unfortunately is not being discussed. What do people do with the information you provide them with? And I think it's important because now there's some internets that want to know to continue your coverage, like Yahoo, what you have in your bank accounts, savings accounts, safety deposit boxes, any and all assets you have, all your credit card information. Why do they need that? That's your private information. Yet people will willingly give this over. What does that say about the people who don't care about any privacy issues in their life? They have none, and they could care less. Oh, and by the way, the number one users of the internet historically have been people watching porn. Well, guess what the companies are doing? They're not just going back to review all the porn that you have watched, but categorize your fetishes, your fantasies, and build a profile, a sexual profile on you. Why would they need to do that? How possibly could that help you? How could that hurt you? These are the issues that we should discuss. Now, throughout this program, our talkback number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. If you have issues you'd like to address, please do so. While you're thinking about what you'd like to address on the issue of privacy, corporatizing and then monetizing the information they're getting, let's hear this. Why Incompetent People Think They're Amazing by David Dunning.
Are you as good at things as you think you are? How good are you at managing money? What about reading people's emotions? How healthy are you compared to other people you know? Are you better than average at grammar? Knowing how competent we are and how our skills stack up against other people's is more than a self-esteem boost. It helps us figure out when we can forge ahead on our own decisions and instincts and when we need instead to seek out advice. But psychological research suggests that we're not very good at evaluating ourselves accurately. In fact, we frequently overestimate our own abilities. Researchers have a name for this phenomenon, the Dunning-Kruger effect. This effect explains why more than 100 studies have shown that people display illusory superiority. We judge ourselves as better than others to a degree that violates the laws of math. When software engineers at two companies were asked to rate their performance, 32% of the engineers at one company and 42% at the other put themselves in the top 5%. In another study, 88% of American drivers described themselves as having above-average driving skills. These aren't isolated findings. On average, people tend to rate themselves better than most in disciplines ranging from health, leadership skills, ethics, and beyond. What's particularly interesting is that those with the least ability are often the most likely to overrate their skills to the greatest extent. People measurably poor at logical reasoning, grammar, financial knowledge, math, emotional intelligence, running medical lab tests, and chess all tend to rate their expertise almost as favorably as actual experts do. So who's most vulnerable to this delusion? Sadly, all of us, because we all have pockets of incompetence we don't recognize. But why? When psychologists Dunning and Kruger first described the effect in 1999, they argued that people lacking knowledge and skill in particular areas suffer a double curse. First, they make mistakes and reach poor decisions. But second, those same knowledge gaps also prevent them from catching their errors. In other words, poor performers lack the very expertise needed to recognize how badly they're doing. For example, when the researchers studied participants in a college debate tournament, the bottom 25% of teams in preliminary rounds lost nearly 4 out of every 5 matches. But they thought they were winning almost 60%. Without a strong grasp of the rules of debate, the students simply couldn't recognize when or how often their arguments broke down. The Dunning-Kruger effect isn't a question of ego blinding us to our weaknesses. People usually do admit their deficits once they can spot them. In one study, students who had initially done badly on a logic quiz and then took a mini course on logic were quite willing to label their original performances as awful. That may be why people with a moderate amount of experience or expertise often have less confidence in their abilities. They know enough to know that there's a lot they don't know. Meanwhile, experts tend to be aware of just how knowledgeable they are, but they often make a different mistake. They assume that everyone else is knowledgeable too. The result is that people, whether they're inept or highly skilled, are often caught in a bubble of inaccurate self-perception. When they're unskilled, they can't see their own faults. When they're exceptionally competent, they don't perceive how unusual their abilities are. So if the Dunning-Kruger effect is invisible to those experiencing it, what can you do to find out how good you actually are at various things? First, ask for feedback from other people, and consider it, even if it's hard to hear. Second, and more important, keep learning. The more knowledgeable we become, the less likely we are to have invisible holes in our competence. Perhaps it all boils down to that old proverb: when arguing with a fool, first make sure the other person isn't doing the same thing. Did you enjoy this lesson?
Okay. So, I think we can all learn something from this. In fact, it reminds me of something that the great theorist Thomas Fuller said. He said, "Zeal without knowledge is fire without light." What Clarence Darrow, the great Scopes trial attorney, said, "I do not pretend to know what many ignorant men are sure of." Let me give you a couple examples of that just to show you the problems. When I went down to Occupy Wall Street on the first day, no one was there, small group of people. And the people I interviewed, at least that day and on subsequent days, because I was there every day for almost 2 weeks, and then I went to the one in Washington, D.C., in Philadelphia, and I found the same phenomena. Young people who had some notion that there was inequality, wanting to address it. That's good. That's noble. I supported that. But then when I suggested that if they were against the corporatocracy, and that's what they were, the what they called the 1%, and then I ask a simple question: what do you mean by 1%? Well, there's 1% of the people that have everything and they control everything, and the rest of the people, the 99%, don't. So I gave them a simple, I remember standing there, and the group I was with, by the way, all of them, every single one, were college students from New Jersey and New York colleges. They all had wealthy or upper mobile parents. They were careerists, lawyers, doctors, engineers. They didn't pay for their way through college. They didn't have to worry about the debt. They didn't have to worry about credit cards being paid. All that was taken care of by a mother or father. That still, in and of itself, that does not in any way dilute the power of someone who wants to commit themselves to inequality, which we all should support. But then I did some math, and I said, we have, at that time, we had 8 million millionaires. We now have 10. If you have 4 people per family, you're dealing with 32 million Americans right there. And then at that time, we had about 17 million, 17.2 million professionals, lawyers, doctors, engineers, and with family. But you put the two groups together, and you're dealing with about 110 million people, or approximately 33%. And so I said, so if you're talking about the Bill Gates and the Warren Buffetts, the wealthiest Americans, you're talking about 1/10,000 of 1%. We had about that time around 250 millionaires. We now have a little over 300, and China's just overtaken us. So then where is the 1%? It doesn't exist. But they didn't like that idea that they were being contradicted. Instead of saying, oh, we hadn't thought about that, they doubled down. So when they doubled down about, we believe we're right, I said, well, if you're against corporatization, across the street is a corporation, and on the other corner is a bank. Do any of you have credit cards from that bank? And when I asked one of the people to show me their wallet, every single credit card came from a corporation that they were supposed to against. But then all their clothes were designer clothes, and most of those designer clothes were made in Indonesia or in Pakistan and other countries in that area that use very cheap labor. And so when I said that women frequently get 14 cents an hour, so if you say you're for women's rights, but then your actions are against women's rights, Bangladesh, for example, it's the largest group of women who are living the shortest lifespan of any working group because they work long hours and they're paid nothing, just 14 cents an hour. Then they got angry, and I said, well, you're eating McDonald's. That's a major polluter of our environment and causing, environmental change. Every single thing they said that they were against, they actually were enabling and supporting. So with this idea that there are people who will say that they're for something, but then the amount of ignorance that they are manifesting clearly shows that they should spend a lot more time thinking they're less amazing because they showed up. If you show up for anything in life without being prepared, it's a meaningless gesture. That was just one example. Then I also suggested, why don't you bring some of the older, wiser African-Americans, Latinos, people from other cultures and other countries who can talk about movements to help liberate, educate, and emancipate people from different groups over a period of time? No. It's as if you were over 30, you were excluded from this movement. Well, movements are not very successful if they pride themselves in who they exclude. But then again, virtually all of the identity politics and virtue shaming that's done today are done to exclude one group of people and then shame them, as if because you're bringing that shame to them, you are empowered. I'll give you an example. The Academy Awards, 500 armed security and police to protect people who claim that they're against guns. Jennifer Lawrence is probably the greatest representative of pure, unbridled hypocrisy, and a person who clearly is not as bright as their career would have you believe, because her latest movie is one of the most violent movies you're ever going to see, using guns and killing people. And though she did a good job acting in it, and she was paid an astronomical amount of money, did she bring homeless people into her home? Did she go and pay for homeless people to have food and to get back on their feet? No. Did she use bodyguards to be at these events? Yes. Are they armed? Yes. Does she have a protected environment which she lives in, like a walled environment? Yes. So let's see. You're against people who want to arm themselves, but everything you do is about making money off violence. And this is the whole unbridled hypocrisy that we live in. That's why I said I've come to a point in my life where I have to prove anything before I believe it. But that's that level of utter incompetence, but thinking they're amazing because they're successful. Like Leonardo DiCaprio winning an award for environmentalism and then flying from the Cannes Film Festival to pick up the River Keepers Award from Robert F. Kennedy on a private jet and then flying back on a private jet. It's just utter hypocrisy. And then going out with friends on one of the largest yachts in the world, a 500-foot yacht. Think of the amount of pollution that puts into the environment. So what a person says is meaningless to me. I don't give a damn what anyone says about anything. It's what you do that impresses me. So you do something that matches what you say, you've got my attention and my respect. Otherwise, no. I also remember, give you a true example, some people I know want to open a restaurant, healthy restaurant. Now, I had opened and had three of the most successful health restaurants in America, including the first gourmet vegan restaurant up on 108th and Broadway, the Fertile Earth. And it was a wonderful experience, wonderful place. And so I said I would contribute my insights. One of the persons was very successful. We're talking about uber rich, very wealthy, a billionaire. And the other people had neither experience in restaurants or in management or in food, and they were all coming in together. Needless to say, that experience was not a good one. Why? Because the people believed that as long as you were successful in one field, you could translate that success into another. Now think of all the people that go to Davos each year, flying on private jets, though they're very concerned about the environment, and then because they're worth at least $1 billion, they're given a seat at the table. People seek them out. Why is that important? What if you know nothing about human nature or the environment or cooperation or how to communicate with people? You just know how to make money. Well, today that's the only criteria you have to create a pedigree of being acceptable. Make money. No one's going to question, in most cases, how you made it. So here was people who knew nothing about the restaurant business, but certain they would succeed simply because of success in other areas. Didn't work out that way. No one apologized for their ignorance, and it was palpable. No one learned any lesson because, well, unfortunately, when people have made mistakes who historically in their own field have been successful, they deny their culpability, and hence they learn nothing from that. So in that respect, grossly incompetent in that field, though amazingly competent in another field. Now, for the last part of our program today, we're going to listen to Ray McGovern give you some insights up until the end of the show about what's really going on in the Middle East. And I had Ray McGovern on briefly to talk about some of the conflict in Israel. This takes you a little broader in perspective. And I feel it's very important we learn this from such a wise man who has spent 52 years in Washington, D.C., 27 years in the CIA as an analyst and creating the president's national security briefings each day.
There's no possibility of conducting a frank discussion on U.S. policy in the Middle East without talking about the U.S. relationship with Israel. People are completely confused trying to explain our policy towards Syria. Doesn't make any sense. Syria a threat to us? No. Why does Bashar al-Assad have to go? Or because Obama said so, or because Hillary Clinton says so? Well, why did they say so? If you don't understand where this policy originates and comes from, then you're at sea in trying to explain it. If you look back to 1996, there was a study done for a fellow who was about to become prime minister for the first time. His name was Netanyahu. It was completed mostly by Americans. We later called them neocons. There were several prominent ones. Douglas Feith, number three in the Pentagon under George W. Bush. There were other people, and most of them, as I say, were Americans. Richard Perle is the other person I was thinking of. He was head of Rumsfeld and its defense departments at Brain Trust, his research group. So they composed this thing, and they called it a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm. Okay, securing the realm. What realm? Well, the realm was Israel, greater Israel, Israel that expanded and occupied territories during the 1967 war. It's very explicit. It talks about the need to make sure that Syria is pretty much blown apart. Iraq, the language is, well, Iraq is a prize in its own right. We need to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and then we'll go on to Iran and other places. It's right out there. Okay, it's in black and white. It's written by Douglas Feith, Richard Perle, and others. Now, that's 1996. Several years later, there was the Project for a New American Century, populated by the same people, who decided that we really needed to advance Israel's interests. And the first and foremost thing we do is we get rid of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Therefore, he won't be a problem for the Israelis. Now, the Israelis, curiously enough, would have preferred us to do Iran first. Matter of fact, some of the neocons that really swagger around said, Iraq? They have no military to speak of. Real men go to Tehran, right? Say that, yeah? One of them said, Iraq is going to be a cakewalk, right? Okay. But that was the plan, all right? Now, if you fast forward to what's going on in Syria now, after we pretty much destroyed Iraq, I'm talking strategically here, but we're really talking about human beings. Not only the 5,000 U.S. troops that were killed about Iraq, but I was going to say hundreds of thousands, at least hundreds and thousands of Iraqis dead because of the war, all manner of people injured and wounded, and refugees. Well, we know about the millions of refugees internally in Iraq, externally in countries around its periphery. The same with Syria. Now, what happened in Syria? Well, 2011, there was an attempt to do kind of a Arab Spring in Syria. There had been economic difficulties, there had been drought, and there had been people that said, hey, we ought to take advantage of this opportunity in Tunisia and Cairo. Let's see if we can get a little bit more democracy here. Immediately, that was seized upon by people who wanted to do Bashar al-Assad in, including Hillary Clinton and, by extension, Obama. So what happened? Well, we started finding moderate rebels to support. Well, even Obama said 2 years ago now that talking about moderate rebels in Syria is a fantasy. Fantasy, his word. All of a sudden, as if, like Lazarus coming out of the tomb, moderate rebels have been resurrected now, okay? We're supporting them again, except for some new qualitative difference that came about as a result of the Russian intervention. Now, the background is that we, in my view, cannot understand U.S. policy toward the Middle East, and specifically Syria, without understanding how our policymakers really brag about there being no daylight between the policies of the United States and the policies of Israel. That doesn't do us any good among the Arab states out there, okay? So if that's the case, why is it that our president, Barack Obama, decided on August 20, 2012, to draw a red line? Okay? Now, we all knew that Syria had chemical weapons. They were left over from when they got supplied by various and sundry. There was never any suggestion they were going to use them. It would be suicide immediately because the Israelis would nuke them or whatever. But Obama was asked a question at the very end of a press conference, sort of an unusual thing. Oh, Mr. Obama, you said that you would intervene militarily in Syria unless you're never going to intervene militarily in Syria? And then Obama, as if reading a script, said, well, if the Syrians were to use or even just to move their chemical weapons, then I would draw a red line there, his words, okay? Then I would change my calculus, I would change my approach to Syria.
Red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus.
Yeah, intimating that, well, there would be U.S. military intervention. Now, who told Obama, who gave Obama that question and told him the answer? I don't know, but it's a safe guess it was Hillary Clinton, okay? Okay, that was August 20, 2012. August 21st, 2013, virtually a year later, there's a chemical attack outside Damascus, a place called, what's it called? Ghouta. Several hundred people died. Immediately, John Kerry got up. Well, not immediately. He got up on the 30th of August and said, Bashar al-Assad's government did this, Bashar al-Assad's government did this, Bashar al-Assad's regime is just guilty of this chemical attack. Therefore, we drew this red line. Mr. President's got to act. How many times did he blame it on Bashar al-Assad? 35 times. 35. You know, you don't have to be a Shakespearean scholar to remember, you know, methinks he doth protest too much. Now, that was the 30th of August. This is the most, well, it's the strangest set of circumstances I've ever seen, and I've been around here 53 years, okay? What happens next? Well, it was very clear. The president himself pretty much said, okay, this is it. Our forces are ready in the Eastern Mediterranean. The French have their fighter bombers ready on the tarmac. And he was going to give a speech in the Rose Garden around noon the next day. I'm out in front of the White House with several other people protesting, saying, hands off Syria, don't bomb Syria, no shock and war against Syria. And I get word from inside, he's not going to do it. He changed his mind. And I, you know, I was the next speaker up, and yeah, I used the subjunctive in a way they never used before. If this is true, you know, this would be, you know, I couldn't believe it. But he changed his mind, okay? Now, why did he change his mind? A couple of reasons. The intelligence colleagues, our former colleagues in the intelligence community, wouldn't go along with what Kerry had to say. The evidence stunk. We knew that the Turks were facilitating precursor chemicals right into the parts of Syria where this chemical attack took place. We knew and we learned from our colleagues that it was much more likely that it was the rebels themselves who did it in a classic false flag attack to mousetrap Obama into an overt war against Syria. And he was about to be mousetrapped.
Okay, there you have a whole history lesson of what really went on behind the scenes. And if it were not for that, then Assad would have been destroyed. We would have created a no-fly zone over all of Syria. Syria would have been decimated. Probably in the neighborhood of 7 million Syrians would have been kept captured and beheaded or killed because the persons who would have been taking over would have been our moderate head-chopping rebels. Okay, so that's a little behind the scenes. Assad has not been found guilty of any of the three alleged bombings of his own people. Those were our people who did it. Just a little history lesson. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's up now? Brother, what's up? This is a big party, man. Yeah, brother, I can dig it. Stop right on.